Hello, David Gill just jumping in here. You may hear on this episode that my audio is a little bit off for whatever reason. Hopefully it won't affect your enjoyment of this episode too much, but just as a little awareness for it, as a one-off. So thank you very much and enjoy the episode.
Hello and welcome to this episode of the Frontline Podcast. I'm Andrew James.
I'm David Gill.
And in this episode, it's going to be building on something that we started talking about in previous episode, episode 3, when we started talking about initial service user engagement. But I think in this episode, we want to talk a little bit more generally about engagement with others and how best to do that, in what ways we do that, and positives and negatives, and what can kind of the impacts and implications of those techniques bring. I'm going to kickstart something from my perspective in building rapport with other people. Generally, in my old working life, I worked in a court-based setting. So I generally worked in that for so long that I genuinely believe that I was best there, because if I was in the field, on a more general working day-to-day, building the rapport, I genuinely got a bit concerned that I'd forgotten how to build up and manage and maintain actual engagement and rapport with clients, with service users, because I hadn't used those skills. So just in your own personal perspective, David, just what immediately jumps out to you in terms of tenets when it comes to not just initial, because we've already covered initial, but just general relationship maintaining and keeping that engagement?
Yeah, I think this is why we wanted to discuss it this episode, because we're now August 23 and that episode was October 22. So it's a long period of time, worrying a long period of time. And as you say, everything we talked about at that point was about, you know, building and maintaining, but it was primarily about that initial service user engagement. And I think from the pods that we've done over the months, and I guess just the conversations we've had, it has become really evident about that maintaining relationships is vital. And as you say, that it's often to do with the environments we're in. And if things change, our jobs change, our circumstances change, we suddenly become aware of what our skills are and perhaps where our skills lack. And it really is dependent on the jobs that you do, your own kind of experience, but also your own kind of unique personality as well. I think the danger with anything around this is that we make it so that you become a bit of a robot, or you see other people doing something, you try and replicate it. This isn't to say there aren't certain themes, there aren't certain approaches that we can sort of utilize. And I think that's primarily what this episode is about, is looking at those themes. Because just before we recorded, I mentioned to Andy this statement that's always stuck with me by an American author called Stephen Covey, who famously said that we judge ourselves by our intentions and others by their actions. And that's really stuck with me, is that, you know, we kind of react by what we see, but in our heads, we have our own ideas. You know, it's that old saying that we're never the bad guy in our story, we're always the hero. We can look at it from our perspective. And when you do jobs like this, which is about helping and supporting or offering a service to the community, is that we do it because we care. We do it because we want to make a difference. But sometimes we're coming at it from such a perspective, we might miss what that other person is truly wanting to say or act or behave. So I think when you talk about the basics of this, for me, it's doing our best to try and understand what might be, because we're never going to know for sure, but what might be going on for that person that's in front of us.
And I think that, building on from what you just mentioned there about, yeah, you're never the bad guy in your story, you're always the hero. That's, I think, one of those things that you can kind of miss or take for granted in a bit of a way, I think, because you can get so embedded and bogged down in your own world, your own story. Even if you know, you can be a very conscientious employee, you can be a very conscientious worker, be very diligent in what you do and do it to a high level, but there'll still be times when you will be so lost in what you're doing that the world's going by. The focus is just there. That the outside world doesn't really get much of a look in. So you've only got your own personal story going on in your head. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly natural. But it's when that gets taken into meetings, into situations when you can no longer see from someone else's perspective. You're only looking at things in that rigid style and that rigid viewpoint that I think problems can start to develop and develop very quickly.
When you use the example there about the courts and like how you almost become institutionalized in your settings, it made me think of a time I had in my career. It's weirdly, for I'm going to make us feel old now, but it was about the time when me and Andy first met, which was about 14, 15 years ago, something like that. Don't freak out when I say that. But at that time, I came to work in the community, having worked in a prison. And I remember, like, when I first started working in a city with people in different places, it was such a bizarre experience, because I remember in the first week going, bloody hell, I'm so used to working in a prison environment with a certain people in a certain way. What's this mean for me? It was almost like I'd become institutionalized in that environment. And there was a lot of fear and a lot of anxiety in myself, thinking I couldn't act in that way. I couldn't behave in the way that I would like. I couldn't engage with people in the way that I would like, because I was so used to working in such a rigid set way. It was only when, I guess, you kind of have a few weeks getting yourself your head around things that you realize it's the same skill set. You just got to tweak things here and there. But it can make you aware when you change jobs or you change what you do in the jobs. It can make you aware of perhaps your own anxieties or fears that perhaps you can't do something, or perhaps you can't do it to a level that you would like to.
It almost seems comical to think about it in isolation, but that routine, it's something that can be, it can bring so much comfort because you know what's coming. It can be so relaxing because you have a clear path. But it's also incredibly, if not managed and watched carefully, it can be quite damaging, because it can limit you in ways that are completely unforeseen and unexpected until they are right in front of your face. And it only has to take that minor little shift, that minor little change, and it can be really brought to the fore that, you know, you can be very uncomfortable very quickly. Yeah. But that's something that we're discussing from the side of a worker's relationship. I mean, to consider that from the view of a service user, someone coming in, that is the entire shattering of their routine, especially if it's a prescriptive service that they're working with, having to come to see you. And if you're feeling that anxiety and discomfort from a professional side, you can only imagine what sort of anxiety and confusion that must bring to people that we work with on a regular basis.
As we discussed in previous episodes, and you know, a big chunk of what we do in our day-to-day jobs is around that trauma-informed approach. It's understanding this has been a shift, because, as you said, classically what we've done is we've looked at the staff perspective. What do I need to train you up? What techniques have you got to engage with this person? Almost like this classic way of looking at things is almost assume that the service user in front of us, the client in front of us, is a really passive in this process, is that they will just adhere to and work with whatever we do to them. And I think what the last 10, 15 years has really started to show us in our understanding of trauma-informed approaches is that they are absolutely not passive. They are incredibly complex, dynamic, chaotic human beings, because guess what? We all are. And I think what this has started to do is make us realize that there's two parties involved, two chaotic, crazy human beings. And yet somehow we've got to figure out how we connect. And particularly when you are a professional, because you've got that duty of care, that responsibility to try and really do the best for that individual, even if you are struggling to build that relationship, even if you find that person challenging, difficult, or they are pushing your buttons, we've still got to find a way to maintain those relationships.
And often when you do have someone like that and you are working with someone like that, if you can break through, you can't always, and sometimes that is just how things are. But when you have cases like that you can break through to, and you see even just a small amount of change, a bit, little bit of positive difference, those can sometimes be some of the most rewarding cases that you have. Exhausting, yes. Challenging, absolutely. But the reward of actually seeing some of the work that you've been trying to do break through and start to turn things even slightly, you could work with someone much easier and make a much, much, much bigger turn. But those cases where there's the work, the effort and the struggle can be much more of the rewarding ones.
Absolutely. And I think it's really interesting you say that. Because again, if you go back to, I sound like an old man here, back in the day. But you know, if we talk about a few years ago, there was too much of an emphasis from my perspective of looking at people and demanding or expecting that we would see huge changes in their life. And if they weren't changing in a huge way, it was almost our fault for not doing it, or we weren't good enough. When in fact, as you just said then, that actually those little wins are the biggest wins, because they become cumulative. One win after another starts to build bigger and bigger wins. But if we're looking at the wider challenge here, the wider systems issues, the tick in the box, the KPIs, the targets, they all demand these big targets: crime-free, drug-free, secure housing, all of those wonderful stuff that we want for everyone. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of steps that we all must get through to hit that point, particularly if we have a history of adversity, poverty, trauma that comes with us. And you know, we're fighting all of that past to try and get to these big points. We must focus on those little things as well. So when we are talking about relationship building and maintaining, we have to think about how we are working towards that end goal. What does that end goal actually look like? And when we do achieve these things, how do we celebrate them? How do we recognize that that's a sign that we're doing some really, really good stuff?
You mentioned one thing earlier on, which is talking about the techniques and the tools that we have at our disposal to manage and approach these situations. And I think that this is probably a good time to bring in our guest, who will discuss neuro-linguistic programming.
Hey, and welcome to this episode's guest. With us, we have Alan Johnson, who is a trainer, a personal coach, and a change worker. And today he is going to be discussing the world of NLP. So over to you, Alan. Do you want to give us a bit of an introduction about who you are, what you do, and maybe perhaps a background on what NLP actually is then?
Yeah, thanks, David. So I'm Alan Johnson. I'm also known as That NLP Bloke. So I'm a trainer and a coach and a therapist, mainly training NLP, which is neuro-linguistic programming. I also train other therapeutic approaches, specifically in relation to trauma, integral eye movement therapy, which is an eye movement therapy, which I'm sure we'll mention as we go along. But my background is originally in nursing. So I was a general nurse and a mental health nurse, mostly working outside of the NHS. So I worked in probation service, prisons, and a lot of the time I worked in drug and alcohol services. So I worked with a lot of people in social and emotional need, possibly more than medical need. So I very much got a social emotional approach to things. But also had my own mental health problems in my 20s, quite bad depression. And it set me on a journey of wanting to understand how I ticked. So I knew that the medication might work, but if I didn't change the way I was, I'd be vulnerable to that the rest of my life. So I went off looking for answers as to what made me tick, what makes me upset, how do I react to things, how can I get more control of the inside world. And I found I did quite a few things, initially counselling and then on to other more sort of new age stuff. But NLP was the thing that really spoke to me, because I think it's really simple, which I like, really understandable and easily applied. And from there, it helped me, it's helped my relationships, it's helped my, definitely as an employee when I was a leader, it helped my leadership skills, and more importantly, helped me working with people in distress, people who possibly haven't found an answer to the problems they're facing emotionally, socially, psychologically. The main thing I train is actually not a therapy as such, it's a communication model, it's a way of understanding how people tick. So one of the best things is it gives simple ideas around patterns that we run, unconscious patterns that we run, So if I can understand my unconscious patterns, and then I can understand your unconscious patterns, if I can communicate in your psychology more than from my psychology, there's more chance that we're going to connect, get good rapport. And then, of course, if you've got rapport, you've got opportunity to influence. And that is essentially a really good way to get people to trust, to believe that you can support and help them, if it's from a support and help angle. But also just generally allows people to be happier and calmer by understanding what they are, who they are, what's the world, what's them, what's the world, where the boundary lies, and how do I put myself in the best shape on the inside to get the... You know, some days you have a good day, everything seems to go well, and then other days you have... It seems as though you wake up in a grump and everything goes wrong. I think NLP can help, or certainly help me, have more good days more of the time, and also more good interactions with people more of the time, which means I've got less to worry about, which means I'm less stressed. And if there's underlying stress or underlying anxiety, then it helps people cope better with their world.
NLP then, where does it come from? What's the history about this? Because you hear people talk about it quite a lot, like say you train in it. So kind of what's NLP's journey been, and where is it right now here in 2023 then?
Yeah, it's been around over 50 years now. So it was around 1970 in California, as you might guess, in the University of California. There were two guys who were credited with the majority of the creation of NLP, but there were more people around at the time. There's the two guys, John Grinder, who was a young professor of linguistics, and Richard Bandler, who was a student at the university, get the credit because they wrote the first book, or some of the first books. But it was created out of curiosity, really, that outside of the university, they were going to happenings and events, and they got curious about therapy, because at that time, and possibly now, in California, a lot of people had a therapist. And they were curious just to understand, how do some therapists get consistently good results, and how do some therapists not? So they had a theory that if we model the people we think are good therapists and extract the commonality that they've all got, so we take away the personality, the quirkiness, the specific things, so if there's things that are common across all three people, then that must be the kind of DNA, the formula for good therapy, which then means you can pass that on to anybody. So NLP essentially is all around modeling how people tick. So people who've naturally learned to do something well, it started by modeling them. So it started by modeling therapists. Then they thought, well, can we model how somebody's overcome a phobia? So they asked for hundreds of people to be modeled to see what's the structure of getting over a phobia. They did it with PTS. They did it with allergy. They did it with all sorts of things. So NLP effectively is modeling. There's a few definitions, but modeling excellence, modeling how people already do things really well. So if you're curious, in a workplace, for instance, if you want to understand how three people do the job really well and one person doesn't, the tendency might be to go to the person who's got issues, inverted commas, and examine what's going wrong for them. But it actually make more sense to go to the three who are doing it well, or for model them, find out what they're doing, and then pass it on to the person who's struggling. Because NLP works on a basis that we're all unique, that the world I live in is the world in my head. The outside world is very little to do with the way I'm doing me. So we all have a map in our head that we operate from. We all live in a common territory. We all live in the world. But actually, what affects my reactions is what I'm doing on the inside. And so when it comes to trauma, this is how it's really important to understand that the same stimulus on the outside will not create the same response on the inside. So people living in the same household, one child might develop trauma reaction and the other child might not. In the battlefield, so the army statistics are something like 10% of people who experience events will get to post-traumatic stress. So 90% of people don't respond in that way. And that's mostly to do with the history they've had. So have they had childhood trauma, ACEs, but also how are they reacting and responding on the inside? So everybody's got a unique set of responses. One of the ways to introduce NLP is to say to people when they enter the room, you didn't expect anyone in this room to look like you, did you? You didn't expect there to be clones sitting there. So there's 10, 20 clones of you sitting next to each other. that would be A, very scary, and B, be quite boring if we're all the same. So we just naturally expect everyone to look different, a different age, different hair color, skin color, eye color, etc., etc. Yet a lot of people think everyone thinks like me, don't they? Or everyone feels what I feel, don't they? And that's simply just not true. And I think the diversity on the inside is hundreds and hundreds and thousands of times more diverse than that on the outside. But when we get people who are very, my way is the right way, this is what happens with a non-trauma-informed approach is, well, I could do it, why can't you? I found it easy, why don't you? It didn't traumatize me, how's it traumatized you? And when people are very much, I'm right, I'm correct, that's the only way, then that's, so some of the learning, the understanding when I'm training staff is about the fact that everyone's unique, that the acceptance and tolerance of difference is at the root of most conflict. So let's be more accepting, let's be more tolerant, understanding that just because something's right for you doesn't mean it's right for me.
What would you say, before we look at the positives, I always think it's worth exploring perhaps some of the misconceptions that people might bring up, or perhaps some, negative views of things, because I think it's always worth putting things in balance. From your perspective then, would you say there are some common misconceptions and how you kind of deal with them and how you challenge them perhaps?
Yeah, there are many misconceptions. As with anything that's powerful, it hasn't always been used well by people. And still, there is a very strong mixture of people using what they call in NLP, whether it's actually NLP or not. So it has had a bad press over the years, on and off. If you go to Wikipedia, the page isn't very flattering. The guy who edits the page won't let anybody edit it, and he doesn't like NLP. So it's because it's... more conceptual part rather than evidential. So it is a mixture of a science and an art, and there aren't many studies on it. And when people go to study it, they're using medical model study, which doesn't really ask the right questions, so it doesn't seem to work. So as an ex-nurse and someone who's quite a geek, I'd love to say there's loads of research and evidence for this, as in documents and studies that are triple sort of checked by everybody, but there aren't. It is something that's almost an approach, a way of being, a model for communication that's effective. And it's almost, are there any written studies about politeness? Or are there any written studies about love? It's one of those things that's really difficult to quantify, that if I just be different slightly in the way I think and feel and behave, then I could be exceptionally different in my responses to the world, etc., etc. So it has had a lot of... mixed reviews out there because it's been picked up by the manipulation market. So there are some people out there use it to manipulate people, pickup artists who manipulate women, con artists. So it is something that's really, really powerful. And of course, the main thing with anything that's powerful is the ecology of how you use it. So electricity is powerful. It will cook your lunch, but it could also cook you. It depends how it's used, doesn't it? And anything that's powerful, it's down to the individuals using it. And I understand people's caution about things that seem a little bit quick fix, or seem a little bit out there, a little bit woo-woo. So again, it's that credibility factor. It's working with people who have the right credibility for the person wanting it. So some people that train NLP do it from a coaching, sales, kind of get the best out of your world. Tony Robbins is a NLPer. So the people, you know, very high energy, very high powered, you know, go out and achieve whatever you want to achieve. And that's not my approach. And then there are people who use NLP in a very kind of really touchy-feely, very, very deep sort of therapy way. That's not really me. Having worked in the public sector, being from a working class background in the public sector, working with lots of people who are very, very troubled emotionally and socially, having had 30 plus years of working with people in those environments, the way and also being a senior leader in the public sector, so I moved through into commissioning at the last time I was employed. So working with people generally as a leader and as a coach and a therapist, these skills have made things easier for me, and I think made things more effective for the people I'm working with. So it is just when I'm delivering it through the frame of the trauma-informed approach, it is the kindness model. It's just a kindness model. It's a way of understanding that you're not me, I'm not you. So I say to clients, I know what it's like to be me. I don't know what it's like to be you. Please let me know. I am not making assumptions that you think or feel or do anything like me. I'm actually curious to understand how you tick. So therefore, I can understand that and possibly help nudge that for you on the inside, give you some ideas about reframing the way you're doing things at a very basic level.
When you are working with staff, particularly to empower them to work in this way with clients, what sort of key messages do you kind of give them? What's your area of focus, should we say?
I mean, it's the overall approach to actually to yourself first. So the work starts with you. And as a worker, as a person, anybody doing anything, if I've got stuff running on the inside that's not helpful, you know, I think, first of all, I encourage my students to work with their own stuff, you know, whether that's quite small or quite big. Let's clear out the history. Let's make me the most resourced I can be. Because I do talk about you can't drink from an empty cup. You can't help someone unless you are okay yourself. You can't, you know, the old thing about put your own mask on before you attempt to help anyone else. You've got to be well enough emotionally and socially and physically to work with somebody else. So you're just going to drain yourself. So I do talk to staff a lot about self-care and self-regulation, managing their own trauma, their own vicarious trauma, or the way that the systems are harsh and unkind. How do I cope with that? I talk about inoculating yourself from the madness so that you can still work within that system, because we need people with the right attitude working in the system to change the system from inside. Says somebody who's left the system, but it is about influence. So I'm influencing the system at a greater level, I think, by training big groups of people in multiple agencies. And it is about that self-management first. But working with clients, it's that rapport, getting actual rapport, listening to the client, especially children don't get listened to. So listening properly, listening with all our senses. It's very easy to judge. It's easier and lazier to judge. If people are very black and white and just judge, their life is quite simple. It's right and wrong. It's black and white. It's good and bad. But actually, people are like rainbows. It's not black and white. And it's that, how do I have an open mind and how do I listen properly and show the person that I'm interested to understand how they tick? I'm not saying that I'm condoning behavior. I'm not saying anything about it. It's initially, if I listen to someone, then they can stop shouting. It's if someone doesn't have their message heard, they make it louder and louder and louder, and the behavior becomes more extreme. But if at the earlier stage we can acknowledge, I've heard, yes, I've heard that. I'm not saying I agree with it, I'm not saying out loud, I agree with you that your conclusions about yourself are correct. Because in NLP, we talk about sensory information. We take the world in through our senses, and then we run movies in our head. We talk to ourselves in our head. We feel things in our body. That's what's actually going on. But because we're meaning-making beings, we're the only animal that makes meaning, we have to make meaning of that. And we might go, oh, that means I'm scared. That means I'm anxious. That means I'm X, Y, Z. So I'll put a label to those sensations. And then I'll think about that label and I'll say, well, I'm angry. That must mean I'm stupid. And because I'm stupid, that must mean I'm unlovable. Because I'm unlovable, that must mean the world hates me. And I end up operating from the top of that tower. I'm operating all day long from I'm stupid and everyone hates me. And then, of course, if I've got a belief, I'll find more evidence to make it true. One of the biggest things in NLP is whatever I think is going to, in my Google, if you like, whatever I'm Googling for, I'll go and find it. If I wake up and say, well, today's going to be a rubbish day, my Google will go out and find evidence to make it true. And I will ignore anything that's positive because I don't want to be wrong. Have a think. It's a thought experiment. Do you wake up in the morning thinking, let's see how many times I can prove myself wrong today? Or do we wake up thinking, my model of the world's correct and I'm going to prove it more correct and I'm going to challenge anybody or ignore anybody that contradicts it? And equally, whether I say I want or don't want something, so I don't want trouble. Your brain just hears, I want trouble. It's like saying, don't think about chocolate. Don't think about the color purple. Whatever we say we do or don't want, our brain will go and Google for it. So when somebody's mind is focused on fear, because of trauma, because of anxiety, they will see more fearful things. And things that other people would find neutral, they will turn them into fearful things. Because my unconscious is saying, the world's a scary place. I need you to prove that to yourself every day. If we can change the person's focus into, well, actually, 99.9% of things are okay. Let's focus on those. And if things happen, we'll deal with them as they come along, which is what we're meant to do. This is how animals are meant to be. Then that will work. But the media, the social media, it focuses on and explodes things that are bad. and it feels as though the world's scarier than it used to be when it's not. And it's focusing on what I can and can't control as well. So it's very stoic. It actually comes from Stoicism, which is a really ancient philosophy about managing myself to focus on the things that are in my control and not think about the things that aren't in my control. So it gives people tools if they're able to use them. The thing with a lot of the tools is you've got to manage things at an unconscious level first. So the model I would give is it's like an elephant with a rider on top. The elephant is like our unconscious. The rider is like our conscious. We think the rider is in control, but if the elephant was scared, it would run and there's nothing the man could do about it. It's the same with our unconscious. We can have as much willpower as we want, that I'm not going to fight, I'm not going to run, I'm not going to scream, I'm not going to blush, I'm not going to eat chocolate. And our unconscious just waits till we feel vulnerable and goes, guess what? You're going to do that very thing you don't want to do because I know better, because you've got a very young part of you running that program. And those, any one of us listening to this who's ever attempted to change a habit, if you've done that 1st of January New Year's resolution thing, it lasts about 2 days because we're using the wrong part of our brain. We're using our logical, conscious brain to force ourselves to change. And this is where I take issue with some therapies that use talking to change unconscious things, because I didn't have language when this was set down. It's set down in my unconscious, in those pictures, sounds and feelings way down there. And when I start talking about my conclusions, my thoughts and feelings about my thoughts and feelings about my thoughts and feelings about my thoughts and feelings, I'm just colluding with you from a position of detachment, and I'm analysing what I think my world is. But you can't use the thinking that's got you into a problem to get you out of it, or everyone would just do that.
What's been some of the common challenges then that people have about taking this on board and actively practicing it? What for you is the biggest challenges that people face?
So given that we believe what we believe because we think it's true, so our beliefs are our truths about the world, and we make those conclusions based on either watching adults as a kid, so we might pick that up from our parents or the teachers. If a teacher says to us, four-year-old, so it's a very common, so very common stories in childhood. So everything that's problematic that can't shift by talking tends to be set down before the age of seven. Now it might reemerge after the age of seven. And a lot, so I work with a veterans charity, and a lot of the adult battlefield type trauma is as a result of things that weren't processed before the age of seven. So it's a revivification of an old program. So things happened when I was three or four. I couldn't deal with them then because I was too small. I didn't have the logic. I didn't have the emotional awareness. It felt like a massive whole body scare. It went in as an imprint. So therefore it's held in my whole body. It's held in my cells. And talking about that won't work because I didn't have language when language started. But a lot of people are so used to working with language. They've been through counselling. They've been through CBT. They've done things which are analytical as well, psychological analysis. And that just gives me more awareness, but it doesn't make things feel any better in a lot of cases. If it's working, that's great. But in my experience, but I would see people who've tried everything else usually, it's only made people more traumatized to talk about the trauma, to talk about the things that upset them. And so people's challenges are, A, to allow themselves to realize that if they understood it and could use language, it would change. We have to work at a deeper unconscious level. So NLP is one of the tools to do that. But when it comes to trauma, the IEMT, the integral eye movement therapy, which came from NLP, and the fact that our eyes move to different places to access different sensory information, is the most powerful thing that works, actually content-free, to get rid of anxieties, to get rid of other feelings, to get rid of identities, but more importantly, to get rid of post-traumatic stress. Very, very quickly. That doesn't mean the person, you know, it's like a magic wand and everything changes. But the thing that's holding the deep trauma together tends to go away. So you can actually work on helping people get back to a life that they're going to be happy with.
So if that's some of the challenges, let's think about positivity and success. And I think full disclosure for listeners here, I've recently come across a lot of people who Alan has trained, and the feedback I got from people has been universally positive. I think one person described it as life-changing. She said about how it wasn't just the work that she did with people, but it was more on herself. She just completely reshaped everything. So obviously for the people you work with, it's making such a positive difference. From your perspective then, when you are working with people, what's a sign that you can see people getting it? What are the moments where you start to go, I see them getting it now. I can see them starting to think differently.
Yeah, I mean, that can occur on day one, because the model that we show people on day one is, it is almost, it rewrites the way I understand the world. Because most people do, without this kind of training, especially people who don't work with people. So if you take this outside of the context of social care or the kind of people we both tend to work with mostly, if you take it into industry, you take it into other workplaces. I do train people like that. I do train industry. And their concept of people is even more black and white in lots of cases. Oh, they're just awkward. They're just, there's no point talking to them. And we're doing judgment. We've only got people's behavior to work on. We do not know anyone else's thinking or feeling. So we tend to have to make meaning of people's behavior. And we do that often without asking about the unconscious, you know, or what's someone's thinking and feeling. So we get into this mindset that my way of the world's right, or it's maybe I don't like it, but it's the only way to be. And everyone takes the world in like me. And I know that that person's awkward. And I know that that person's difficult. And I know that bad things always happen to me. And I'm making these massive generalizations. And the way I describe it to people is, it's the story you're telling yourself about you and the world. You're attempting to recast that story every day and make it true every day. So when people hear the fact that they're creating their world in their head, that other people actually are mainly not that interested in you, they're doing their thing, you just might not like it. Most people are on the phones anyway, so they're not watching what you're doing. So getting people to realize it's okay to be them unless they think it's not okay to be them. And then if there is something they want to change, it's possible to change it. And I say to people, if you like everything in your life, keep it that way. And if you don't like something about your life, change it, because no one else is going to change. It's up to you to change it. If you can't change it, change your attitude to it. And if that's not possible, find a way to get away from it. Yet people feel really stuck, as if there's no choice. But I'm saying to people, there is a choice. You can come to work and change the way you feel about it if you don't like the job, or you find another job, or in a relationship. So people feel less stuck. And I think I see light bulbs going on morning one when people realize, actually, is it absolutely true that I'm useless at everything? Is it absolutely true that I can't do those things? Or is that just the meaning I've put to it and I'm actually proving it right every day? Is that the story I tell myself? Because if I don't change my story, I can escape to Australia. I hate my life here. I'm going to move to Australia. Within 6 months, I just hate my life and be hot. It's not going to make any difference, because wherever I go, there I am, and I'm taking my story. Until I change my story, my victim story usually, then I will recast that. People who leave a job because it's terrible and they're getting picked on, et cetera, back away into a different job, and it's great for 6 months. And then within 6 months, you've got the same story with different cast members. So I've got to actually change. You know, it's a bit of a tough love model as well when people are ready to change, that actually I need to change. And what people will say is, I want change, but they don't actually want to change anything. But you have to make changes. If you don't change, nothing changes. If I want you to be different, David, I have to change. If I started talking differently to you right now, you'd have to change in response to that. So we influence the world to change if we wanted to change. It will not randomly change. That horrible boss will not stop being a horrible boss randomly. That partner who's difficult will not stop being like that. That whoever it is that I think's giving me trouble is not going to stop doing it, even if I tell them to stop doing it. So I have to change. And that is quite a big, tough love responsibility for people who are used to feeling the way they feel for a long time.
Like you said, it's completely reshaping that perspective on things, and quite a powerful thing. And I guess in a way as well, for some people, it can potentially be quite uncomfortable, because as you say, you're taking yourself out of that comfort zone. So
definitely.
I guess with NLP, it's been on this 50-year journey, and for you, you've been on your own journey with this. Where for you would you like to see things, NLP, start to influence other areas then, or where would you like to work with you currently not working with? Because I imagine there's so many areas that this could influence. What for you would be the ideal next steps for NLP then?
So in a utopian world, we'd be teaching this to 5-year-olds or earlier. So again, that thing about getting to the part, this, instead of getting up, picking people out of the river, get to the where people are getting thrown into the river. So if we can, so my wife works with children using this, and they get a massive understanding of them and the world in it. But if we can educate children and families at a very, very young age about tolerance, acceptance of difference, kindness, being more understanding that people are not all the same, and how we need to collaborate rather than compete. If we can get into people at an early age, that would be perfect. Otherwise, my passion is working with public and voluntary sectors, the people who actually work hands-on with people. And I also think the work we do with the veterans and Blue Light charities really, really important when people have got to that extreme kind of post-traumatic stress end, because there's help at all levels. I think the thing I would like to transform is the hope for people who are suffering with trauma, because the message from the establishment, from the NHS and the army, etc., is that there is no possible change for post-traumatic stress. You have to live with it forever. Now, for someone who's already lost lots of hope, that a lot of people think, well, what's the point? And then other things that they do get in front of, things that they do attempt, the things that attempt to help them can often make it worse for some people. Then, of course, they think, well, there's absolutely no hope. And that is something that I've seen at firsthand with dozens of people and across the charity and the world I work in, hundreds of people who have pretty much lost hope for life, found these kind of non-clinical interventions that work really, really effectively. And I've actually turned their lives around. And that, for me, so they're both ends. So let's get in, let's pre-educate people, let's psycho-educate young people so that when they become teenagers and the hormones rage and the lads feel aggressive and the girls feel shy, that they've got more tolerance for each other, so that as adults, it creates a better place. I am a bit of a hippie, David, so that's a utopian view. But at the other end, when people have, the adults who were those children who are now really suffering, giving them access to things that work instead of long waiting lists, medication, and approaches that tend to make it worse. You can feel the passion in my voice here. This is a real passion of mine. I've seen a lot of things that don't work but are still used in public sector, in the NHS and the armed forces, and the other stuff that we do doesn't get any funding because it's not NICE accredited or whatever it might be. So there's a bit of a loop here, that there is no evidence for this stuff for people who need evidence in a certain format. But I could point you to hundreds of people whose lives have been changed or saved because of this approach, giving them the power back to be more of who they'd like to be. So I think one of the things for me would be making the access to this stuff more mainstream. I certainly don't want the NHS to take it over, because then they would spoil it, and that's a personal view again. I think my opinion is like they've done with CBT, which probably had some validity a few years ago, but now it's become a robotic kind of feelingless process in lots of cases, with the wrong people delivering it. I think the therapist, the person, the intervention, whoever it is, if not a therapist, if you're a worker of any kind, it's your relationship with that person that's the most important thing. Whatever tools you're using will or won't work depending on how you are. So again, more people with the right mindset, that people aren't broken and they don't need fixing. They have just got stuff living inside of them that they can't handle and they need someone to help them.
I guess at this point, if you wouldn't mind, what's perhaps been your own learning? What have you learned about yourself since you've been doing this for the last however many years? What have you learned about yourself that you bring to the table now in the work that you do?
Yeah, and I've been training it almost 19 years, and I've been learning it for sort of 3 or 4 years before that. So it's been quite a long time. I think from a personal level, I don't get low anymore. So it's really helped me stabilize my mood. And a lot of that was to do with the way I was doing the world, which was being harsh on myself here. I was too caring, possibly. So I was a bit of a rescuer, a bit of a fixer and a healer of others. I didn't always look after myself. I wasn't very good at boundary setting. So when I'm working with clients, one of the biggest things is to set boundaries, to be able to say no and mean it, to look after yourself first, to, in NLP terms, not be so externally referenced. So be more sure of who you are, be more happy with who you are, and be less bothered by other people's judgment. So I really don't care what anybody thinks of me anymore. I used to really care what people thought of me, and it didn't help me at all. Because when you please everyone else, you don't please yourself, and you're the person you're with all the time. So the first thing is to please yourself. And that's not to be selfish and hedonistic and, you know, ride roughshod over others, because I hope you can hear that I'm all about kindness and acceptance. But it is about definitely making your own mind up about your world, and you're putting your boundaries in, doing things, live the life for yourself, not for others. And that has got to make people feel happier and calmer, because they're doing what's right for them rather than what other people want them to do. So a lot of, for me, was to become more boundaried. To do that, first of all, though, you've got to understand who you are and what you stand for. You know, that it is a very common phrase these days: if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And it is that ability to be manipulated is less. So I'm much more confident in myself. I'm much more accepting of people who are different to me. And I think generally, I understand me. That's probably the right way to put it. I understand me. I understand what I'm on the planet for. I understand what's right for me and what's not right for me. And in my own podcast, its first episode's called I'm Not Everyone's Cup of Tea. I know that. And I think nobody's everyone's cup of tea. If you were, you'd be a mug. If I'm attempting to be everyone's cup of tea, I'll lose myself. So I am me, and I make it really easy. So sorry, David, some people will have turned this podcast off within a minute of me speaking, because within a minute or two, they'll know exactly whether they like me or not.
I make it really easy for people. They'll have turned off episodes ago when they first heard me talk. So it's happens to us.
Well, yeah, I think we've got similar values, so possibly not. But I make it really easy for people to decide about me, just generally in life. I'm the same person, a bit exaggerated when I'm training. I'm a little bit exaggerated here on podcast. But when you've met me outside of the context of work, outside the context of formal delivery, I'm actually quite introverted and quieter, but I'm the same person. So I'm not putting an act on when I'm training. I'm not putting an act on and pretending to be someone I'm not at any point. I'm just being me, but a bit louder sometimes. And I just make it easy to, you know, because people who people please don't have an identity, because I don't know who you are, because you keep changing your mind and you keep saying whoever's in front of you, you keep saying you agree with them. But then if I don't know where I stand with you, you make me anxious, because I don't know what your response is going to be. Because anxiety only comes from uncertainty. So if I don't know whether you're going to be happy with me today, or sad with me today, or angry with me today, I'm going to get anxious. If you're consistent, even if you're grumpy every day, the consistent person is easier to be around than the inconsistent. You know, a lot of people who have ACEs have had an unpredictable parent or an unpredictable teacher that's nice one day and horrible the next. And they find it really anxiety provoking, because I don't know which version I'm going to get today. But if someone's, you know, grumpy every day, but grumpy with everyone every day, I know where I'm getting. So be consistent. If you want people around you to be calmer, be consistent. Even if you're grumpy, be consistently grumpy with everyone, and they won't be anxious around you.
Great message. I'm just trying to think of anyone I know in my life who's consistently grumpy. But I'm
consistently, consistently happy, even. Be consistent. And this is where, you know, I've worked in prisons. People who are really chaotic outside of prison, and I think the world's changed a little bit in prisons even, but when I worked in prisons, the formality, the structure, the regularity, the anchors, the fact that people knew where they stand and what's happening next, it was relatively calm. You know, I was on a wing with 90 adult prisoners, and there were 3 members of staff. And that is very common. It's like a rule of law. People are allowing themselves to be managed. But because there's familiarity, because most of the time there's a routine, people feel calm. A lot of people who do anxiety because the way they think the world should be isn't happening. I think the world should be like this, and I can't be sure it's going to be like this, so I'm very anxious. So there's a lot of things about acceptance of the way the world is, and the world is not going to please me all the time, then I feel less anxious.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. I think, and particularly like, as you mentioned earlier on, in the current climate, there's just the prevalence of technology and social media. It just gives us more access to things that are going to provoke anxiety within us. So anything we can do to try and challenge that has to be explored. So I think that's really good. And talking about your own experiences there, I think it's fantastic, Alan. So thank you for that.
There's something to remember in the real world or on social media. You don't have to attend every argument you're invited to. And just saying, okay, oh, that's right, to people who've got ridiculous opinions that are just outside of your values or your beliefs, just say something like, that's right, or that's good to know, or okay. Because arguing with beliefs is completely pointless. You are not going to change your belief in a stand-up row or in a ding-dong on Twitter. You're going to hold on to your belief stronger. When someone challenges your belief, you will hold on to it stronger. And you will not like to admit that they're right because you want to win the battle. So when you are being challenged, so those of us who are kind, those of us who do have tolerance and do want people to generally be happy, we probably get called snowflakes, we get called, you know, cuddly fluffy bunny when out in prisons, a cuddly care bear. And A, I didn't care about that. And B, I just think that's a way of undermining kindness. So just ignore it. Just say, okay, that's right. So there's a little meme I use on social media occasionally, which says, hey, dude, how come you're so calm all the time? And then it's like two people talk, and the next one says, well, it's because when people give me stupid opinions, I just say, that's right. Well, that's not going to work. That's right. And it's just letting people live with their beliefs. Mm. Challenging people's beliefs directly doesn't work. Being the way you want people to be in the world might influence them to join you. So you've got to, you know, it's a very old phrase, be the change you want to see. People are judged on what they do, not what they say they're going to do. So we can talk and train and say these things as much as we want, and people can buy me in and get me to train their staff. But unless they change something, it's not going to make those long-lasting changes we need. And it is that. It's the difference between a spoken and a real value. I could say I value trauma-informed approach, but unless I spend my time, energy, effort, attention, and money on that, people are not going to believe me. So there's a word of warning and caution for anyone listening who's bringing people in to train their staff. You've got to let things change, because it's no point keeping a trauma full system and training your staff to be more aware of trauma, because that would make it worse if you're not going to allow it to change. Mm. Awareness raising makes me feel more angry that it's not trauma-informed. People will give you the benefit of the doubt, and they'll give you a long time, because the cultural shift is 10 to 15 years. It's not a quick fix. It's not a change that's going to happen quickly. But I think the majority of people are happy with the intention being sort of steps being taken, even if they're quite slow and small steps. And I would say, you know, to change something 100%, just change it 1% today, it takes 3 months. Change it 1% a week, it only takes 2 years. So if we go for incremental nudge, if we're nudging things 1%, people don't feel scared. Because the other thing, and why I call my company Change Working, is people, it is all about people managing change, and change is always happening. I just might not acknowledge it. And when I don't acknowledge it, I'm actually confronted with the change, I get scared. And people tend not to like change. Even if it's change we want, we can get butterflies about it. So managing change and doing a bit of evolution rather than revolution can often work better, giving people small steps and small nudges away from familiarity. So when I'm working with organizations, I do say to the people, we don't want to be responsible for traumatizing leaders by asking them to change things dramatically quickly when they've had 30 years of working in a certain way. So I think we've got to be mindful of asking people to change gently and safely. Even though my passion is, let's just switch it all right now. It's not going to work, because people will be too scared of that.
Brilliant, Alan. Thank you so much for all your reflections today and all your information that you've given our listeners. It's been invaluable, I'm sure.
Welcome.
So at this point then, if people want to find out more about the services that you operate, the training you deliver, perhaps the podcast that you've mentioned as well, how can people find out about you, your services, your podcast? Where can people go to then?
Great. So the main place is the website, which is changeworking, all one word, .co.uk. And my email is Alan, A-L-A-N, at changeworking.co.uk. I'm not massively across all social media, but I do a lot of Facebook and a bit of LinkedIn. So it's Facebook's Alan Johnson NLP, or that NLP blog, which is my alter ego. And there is a Change Working Facebook page as well. So there's three kind of pages on there. I'm on Twitter at Alan Johnson NLP, and I'm on LinkedIn, Alan Johnson Change Working. I have got accounts for the other social media stuff, but I really, really don't use it. Podcast is That NLP Blog. You'll probably find me through that on your host. There are only 11 episodes at the moment. I do them infrequently. So yeah, catch them when they come out. But if you want a bit more of this attitude, really, most of it's attitude, most of it's mindset, with some, you know, some ideas on language for self and others, some change work techniques. But that should find me.
And thank you very much for coming on and being our guest in this episode. We really appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And welcome back. So that was Alan Johnson from Change Working discussing NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. And I guess at this point, we just want to kind of reflect on what we were discussing at the beginning and what Alan discussed there, and kind of think about how we implement this, how we take this forward. Because as Alan mentioned in the interview there, that approaches like this can sometimes not necessarily be prioritized because they lack that evidence base behind them, which I always find to be a frustrating term, should we say, because evidence-based doesn't always mean that it's good. It just means that someone has said, yeah, I think it can work based on these metrics, based on this. Even if something like this isn't evidence-based, what it actually is doing is giving people an opportunity to practice being a human with someone else. And as I always say to people, if you've got an approach that works and it helps someone, you don't delve into something that you shouldn't be doing. You don't make someone feel unsafe, or you're not causing harm in any other way. It is worth exploring. And I think that ultimately, when we talk about maintaining relationships, it's finding something that is going to work for you, working for the job that you do, the organization, ensure it's in line with the values, and ultimately helping that person that's in front of you, which can be very tricky because there's so much out there. It's just finding something that's going to work for you and what you do.
Yeah, I think this is something that's always been a bit of a personal bugbear of mine, and something that, you know, if I finish talking about this and you see me, I'm stood on a soapbox, I do apologize. But it's one of those things that's constantly pushed at us at workers, which is, you know, you're working with people, you're working with individuals, you're working with wonderful, beautiful, chaotic, difficult, pleasant, whatever, but you're working with individuals with individual needs. But then organizations will then limit the tools. You can only do this. You can only do this way. You must, you're dealing with individuals, but you must use the same tools to deal with them. It shouldn't be that way. As you said there, if you can find a way to get through to someone in a positive, meaningful way and assist in a meaningful change, then surely that's something that you should be doing. Surely it is. Because not everyone is the same. What speaks to you might not speak to me. And, you know, absolutely vice versa. The more strings to people have to their bow, the more skills they have, the better equipped that someone is, the better the worker they are, surely.
And I think this then links in a lot what we said at the beginning, which is, when you do move jobs, or even when you're in the same job, but perhaps you work with different people, or, you know, the contracts change, whatever it may be, this can also help to limit our own fears and our own anxiety, because we go, yeah, right, I might be working with adults, not young people. I might be in a community, not a prison setting now, but fundamentally, my values are the same. The person I'm engaging with is a human being. I can unlock transferable skills there. Yes, I might need to tweak and change things. Yes, there might be something I need to learn about. But ultimately, those core values, that empathy, that caring nature is still underneath. I can still utilize all of that. And for me, and another thing that all this does is reinforce just how vital things like our team around us are. Things like reflective practice, effective supervision with your manager, having all of that in place. Because what that does is it allows you to sit down with your colleagues or your manager and say, you know what, I've been working with this guy this week and I found it really, really difficult. I don't know what it is. everyone else I've worked with has been fine, but this guy, we're just not connected. And it just allows us to bounce ideas off and show that, you know, we are human. And I think for me, one of my takeaways from this is that no matter all the skills that you learn, no matter whatever job that you do, all these wonderful things, there will be times when you work with another human being and you just will not be able to connect with them for no other fault other than sometimes we just do not connect. We've probably all had this in our own lives when you've met friends of friends and you think, oh God, we've got nothing in common. Please don't leave me with this guy. We're not going to be able to talk at all. It's just life. Sometimes there's just going to be moments when we just cannot connect. And rather than beat ourselves over the head, it's about talking. It's about sharing and finding maybe a way around that. Because it might be, and I think this sometimes is, we've seen this as a sign of failure, but we should see it as a sign of just reflecting and being honest that sometimes you might work with someone and go, just isn't working. And your manager goes, why don't we try with someone else? It's not a sign of failure. It's not a sign you're not being able to do your job. It's just, you know what? It's just not working, is it? Let's try something a bit different. And I think all of that, what we talked about today, must fit in with that wider reflective practice, that reflection, that open mindset that, you know, we're constantly learning and developing.
Yeah, and I think that, especially in what you were talking about before, about being aware of your skills and how they work transferably in different environments, especially when you move jobs. A lot of what you were saying there carries into it some of the core principle of NLP, to bring this back to Alan's piece. It's about giving yourself the opportunity to actually praise your own skill base, to tell yourself, to be willing and prepared enough to tell yourself, actually, I can do this. I can do whichever aspect of your job it is. I am good at this. I can do this, and I can evidence this because I've done this with these clients. It's not cockiness. It's not arrogance. It's just reminding yourself and giving yourself the opportunity to accept, you know what? I can do this. So then that gives you a bit more of a lift and gives you the ability to take things forward, rather than if you just sat there and thought to yourself, oh, I'm used to working with people over 18, not under 18. The difference is there are certainly differences in working with younger people than there are with adults. But as you say, the core principle is you're working with a human being, and you can work with human beings. You've proved it. So allow yourself to accept what you can do and take it forward.
Which is classically been a problem with, third sector organisations, statutory organisations, is that we're not very good at celebrating when we're good at something. There's almost been an unwritten rule of, can't do that, that's arrogance. You know, who do you think you are? And in fact, that's the stuff that we need to get better at. We need to recognise when we've got some really good skills and share it, talk about it, because it's how we learn. It's how we learn. We talk, we share, and we recognise what we're good at. But also it helps us to recognise the bits that we need to work on, and then we can work on it rather than bury them down and worry all about them when we really shouldn't do.
Absolutely. And, you know, I guess following on from that, working in third sectors, certain parts of the public sector as well, no one sings your praises. You're often, no one actually knows what you're doing, and no one's actually aware of it until something goes wrong. If no one else is gonna sing your praises and gonna praise your skills that you've worked hard to hone and develop and have an evidence base to prove that you have quality at, do it yourself. Absolutely do it yourself.
That's what we think, as usual. We want to hear what you think. So please do get in touch. I was about to say Twitter, but it's X now.
Oh, yeah.
X, or via LinkedIn. That's the kind of main ways to get in touch with us. Or on our podcast feed, if you want to leave a review. Please, please, please do share this with others. Please do like and subscribe, whatever your podcast feed allows you to do. But we are always looking forward to new guests coming on the show. We've got some exciting people lined up for the next few episodes as well, so you could be one of them if you so wish. So at this point, I guess all that's left for us to say is that I've been David Gill.
And I've been Andrew James.
This has been Frontline.